Welcome to Base by Base. Imagine your body, right? It's like this meticulously organized city, constantly managing its residents, the cells. But what happens when some cells end up with the wrong number of chromosomes? That condition is called aneuploidy. How does the body handle these, well, abnormal cells? And maybe even more surprising, what role do their neighbors play in this cellular cleanup? Today, we're unpacking a really fascinating study that, honestly, dramatically shifts our understanding of this whole process. It's based on a compelling article titled, Depletion of Aneuploid Cells is Shaped by Cell-to-Cell Interactions.
Yes, this is pivotal research. It was led by Dr. Fusari and her colleagues, Elena Fusari, Mariana Musso-Papa, Juliet Gracia, and Marco Milan. It came out in Cell Genomics in 2025, and their work offers some really crucial insights into something that affects us from the very beginning, you know, early embryonic development, all the way to serious health issues later on, like cancer.
Okay, so aneuploidy. Why is it such a big deal? I mean, you might be surprised by just how widespread its impact is. When cells have an imbalance in chromosomes, even just parts of them, the consequences can be, well, dramatic.
Absolutely. In humans, it's a major cause of miscarriages. It contributes to developmental disorders, affects aging, and remarkably, it's found in something like 90% of human solid tumors. 90%.
Wow.
But here's what's truly astonishing. Despite this really negative impact, this kind of chromosomal instability is incredibly common, especially in early human embryos.
How common are we talking?
Get this. Over 80% of human embryos at the blastocyst stage, that's just a few days after fertilization, they show mosaic aneuploidy.
Mosaic meaning a mix.
Exactly. A mix of both normal cells and these aneuploid ones. And yet most of these embryos develop just fine, leading to healthy birth, which implies there's this powerful internal cleanup mechanism, right?
Right.
But later in life, if these aneuploid cells pop up in our regular body tissues, then they're strongly linked to diseases like cancer.
So that's the puzzle Dr. Fusari and her team tackled. How exactly are these aneuploid cells spotted and, you know, eliminated? Is it specific genes that are really sensitive to dosage, too many or too few copies messing things up? Or is it maybe a more general imbalance across lots of genes? And here's the really intriguing part they looked into. How do the interactions between cells, especially in those mosaic tissues where you have normal and aneuploid cells side by side, how does that influence who gets kicked out?
Yeah, that's been the tricky part. Our understanding of the actual mechanisms has been pretty limited. A lot of studies use in vitro models, basically experiments in lab dishes, and those just don't fully capture the complexity of a living organism, you know?
Makes sense.
So figuring this out could genuinely open up some groundbreaking therapeutic avenues for a whole range of diseases.
Okay, so with this big biological puzzle, how aneuploid cells get eliminated, what was the specific question Dr. Fusari and her team really wanted to nail down?
Their main goal was to characterize the immediate impact of very precise, molecularly defined segmental aneuploidies.
Segmental meaning just parts of chromosomes.
Exactly. Imbalances in specific parts. And critically, they wanted to do this in vivo in a living organism. They aimed to figure out if the effects stem from just a few key genes or more global genomic changes, and crucially, what role cell interactions played.
And what was their initial thinking, their hypothesis?
Well, they predicted that cells missing a chromosome segment, those are called monosomies, would probably struggle to grow. Makes sense, right? Missing genes.
Yeah.
But they hypothesized that cells with an extra segment, trisomies, might actually not have a major negative impact.
Interesting.
But the real twist, as their findings showed, turned out to be the absolutely critical role of how cells interact with each other in getting rid of these abnormal cells.
Mm.
So to tackle these questions in a living system, Dr. Fusari and her colleagues turned to a classic model organism, Drosophila melanogaster.
The fruit fly.
The humble fruit fly, yes.
Why Drosophila? What makes it so good for this kind of research?
Well, Drosophila offers an incredibly powerful genetic toolkit. Researchers can manipulate genes with amazing precision. And crucially, it lets you do in vivo studies in growing tissues, like the wing or the eye. These are perfect for watching cell competition happen in real time.
Cell competition.
Yeah.
That's where fitter cells kind of push out the less fit ones.
Exactly. They actively outcompete and eliminate their less fit neighbors. It's a key quality control mechanism. And the researchers used a system called FLPFRT recombination. It's a clever genetic trick sort of like molecular scissors, that let them precisely induce these segmental aneuploidies. We're talking segments containing up to maybe 1,750 genes.
Now, that's a lot of genes.
Yeah.
So how did they actually make these specific imbalances happen inside the flies? That sounds incredibly complex.
It really is sophisticated genetic engineering. They basically use two main strategies. Yeah. Think of the FLP enzyme as the scissors cutting DNA at specific FRT sites they engineered into the fly genome. Okay, so strategy one, let them generate cells that were missing a segment, a monosomy. And they set it up so these monosomic cells would glow red in the adult fly's eye. Makes them easy to spot and track.
Clever. And the second strategy?
The second was even more advanced. It let them create what they called twin spots. This meant after just one cell division, they'd get two neighboring daughter cells. One had the segmental monosomy marked in red. And its sister cell got the complementary segmental trisomy, an extra copy of that same segment, and they marked that one in green.
Ah, so you can see both the loss and the gain right next to each other.
Precisely. This twin spot system was brilliant because it allowed them to directly watch how these different aneuploid cells interacted with each other and with normal cells in a live growing tissue like the fly wing disc.
And could they control when these changes happened to see effects at different times?
Yes, they had two ways. A quick, acute method, like a brief heat shock to the larva to turn on the FLP scissors temporarily, and also a chronic method, where the FLP enzyme was just active throughout development. This let them see both the immediate fallout and the longer-term consequences. Now, the study mostly focused on a large specific region of one Drosophila chromosome, chromosome 3L.
Any particular reason for choosing that region?
Yeah, it was interesting because based on what was known before, it wasn't thought to have many of those super critical haploinsufficient or triple sensitive genes.
Meaning genes where having just one copy or three copies really messes things up.
Exactly. So this allowed them to test whether it was general genomic imbalance causing problems or if specific dosage sensitive genes were the main drivers, even in a region not expected to have many.
Okay, so they could create the aneuploid cells. But I gather they also did some other genetic tricks to figure out the why behind what they saw.
Absolutely. To really dig into the mechanisms, they introduced other genetic changes. For instance, they used flies where programmed cell death or apoptosis was blocked or compromised. They also altered genes involved in how cells respond to stress. Like, they messed with a gene called XRP1, which is known to be a key player in cell competition.
That's XRP1.
And they tweaked MKOR signaling, which is central to controlling cell growth and autophagy. That's the cell's internal recycling system. Plus, they specifically targeted individual genes that suspected might be involved, like RPL26 and flower, to see their direct effects.
Lots of tools in their toolbox. And how did they measure everything? What were the key readouts?
Good question. For the eye experiments, they measured things like how much of the eye was covered by the red marked cells, and they actually counted the individual units of the fly eye, the omatidia, within those clones. That gave them a really precise measure of cell number changes. In the wing disc, they measured the area covered by the red, monosomic, and green trisomic clones. And of course, rigorous statistical analysis was key. They had to account for natural biological variation to make sure their findings were robust. High-res imaging with confocal microscopes was also essential to actually see what was happening at the cellular level.
Okay, let's dive into the results then. First off, did their fancy genetic tools work as well as they'd hoped?
Oh, absolutely. The FLPFRT system was remarkably efficient. They could generate segmental aneuploidies covering really large regions up to 7.5 megabases, which is about 1,200 genes.
Just to put that in perspective.
That's roughly 12% of the entire Drosophila genome, comparable to the average size of a whole human chromosome. So pretty significant chunks. Efficiency dropped a bit for the very largest segments, but overall it was impressively high, a really solid platform for their experiments.
All right, the core findings. What happened when cells lost a chromosome segment, the monosomies? Did they struggle like expected?
They did. The data clearly showed a negative hit on growth, depending on the size of the monosomy. Small ones, up to maybe 400 genes, had varied effects. Sometimes not. But monosomies bigger than that consistently, and quite dramatically, impaired growth. The clones were much smaller.
And was it just bigger is worse?
Interestingly, no. Once they hit that threshold, around 400 genes or so, making the deletion even larger didn't seem to make the growth defect much worse. It was like a critical point had been reached.
Huh. Were there any specific genes within those deletions that stood out as being particularly problematic?
Yes, very much so. They found one gene, RPL26. It's a ribosomal protein gene. Monosomies that included RPL26 caused a really significant reduction in clone size, and this effect seemed almost independent of the total size of the deletion.
So losing that one specific gene was a major hit.
A major hit, yeah. As strong as the effect they saw when deleting genes already known to be haploinsufficient, where losing one copy is known to cause problems, this actually challenges some previous ideas about RPL26.
And for other regions without RPL26.
For other regions, the growth problems seem to stem from the combined effect of a, let's say, a discrete number of dosage-sensitive genes within the segment, rather than just a general more genes deleted equals worse outcome kind of thing.
Okay, so these monosomic cells struggled to grow. Did they just sort of fade away, or was something more active happening with their neighbors?
This is where cell competition really comes into play. They saw that clones of cells with those large monosomies were often fragmented, or broken, as they called it.
Broken.
Yeah, sort of shattered looking, not nice, neat patches. This fragmentation is a classic sign of out competition. It suggests the less fit monosomic cells were being actively eliminated by their fitter neighbors, often through programmed cell death, apoptosis, like the healthy cells were actively pushing them out.
I mean, they messed with the genetics, like blocking cell death pathways. Did that help these struggling cells? Did it stop the out competition?
Well, it depended on which monosomy it was. For the ones involving ribosomal protein genes like RPL26, doing things like blocking cell death pathways, or messing with that XRP1 gene, or boosting autophagy by inhibiting MTOR, those things could partially rescue the cells.
Rescue them how?
They improved their growth a bit, and more of them survived. The clones were bigger and less broken.
Okay, but what about monosomies in other regions?
Interestingly, for monosomies in regions that didn't involve those specific ribosomal protein genes, none of those genetic tricks offered a rescue. Blocking cell death didn't help, messing with XRP1 didn't help.
So the way aneuploid cells get removed might actually be different depending on which genes are affected.
That's exactly what it suggests. Different mechanisms might be at play depending on the specific genomic region involved. It's not a one-size-fits-all process.
That's fascinating, especially this idea of cells with too few chromosomes struggling and getting outcompeted. But what about the flip side? Cells with too many chromosomes, the segmental trisomies. My gut feeling is extra genetic material should also cause problems.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? That's what a lot of previous work, especially in yeast and some human cell lines, suggested. Extra chromosomes often lead to growth defects, stress
Right.
responses. But here's one of the really big surprises from this study. The segmental trisomies, even quite large ones spanning up to 1,500 genes, generally did not show a statistically significant negative impact on the size of the clone.
No negative impact. So they grew normally.
Pretty much normally, yeah. And in fact, some segmental trisomies actually seem to have a slightly positive impact. Their clones were a bit larger than the control cells.
Wow, that is surprising. Completely different from the monosomies.
Very different, and quite a departure from some of the established views based on other systems. It really highlights the importance of studying this in vivo in the context of a developing tissue.
So it really hammers home this idea that the fate of these aneuploid cells isn't just about what's wrong inside them, it's critically about how they interact with their neighbors. This study talks about different flavors of competition based on these interactions. Can you break those down for us?
Yes, they identified several distinct types of interactions playing out in the tissue. First, what they called supercompetition. This happened in certain regions, like their region one. Here, the monosomic cells struggled badly, as expected, but their green-marked trisomic sister clones grew significantly larger than normal control cells. They became super competitors.
And what made it super?
The critical thing was this super competitive behavior of the trisomic cells only happened when their struggling monosomic neighbors were present.
Ah, so the trisomic cells were somehow benefiting from the presence of the monosomic ones.
It seems that way. If they induced the monosomies on their own without the trisomic twin, the growth defect wasn't nearly as severe. It points to a really dynamic interaction where the trisomic cells gain an advantage specifically in that competitive environment. And interestingly, this super competition seemed largely independent of that XRP1 pathway.
Okay, that's one flavor. What else?
Then there was lethal competition. This was even more drastic. It was seen particularly with monosomies involving that RPL26 gene. When RPL26 monosomic cells were generated alongside their complementary trisomic twins, the monosomic cells didn't just grow poorly, they're completely eliminated. None survived.
Whoa, lethal.
Exactly. The presence of the trisomic neighbors turned what was otherwise just a growth defect, haploid insufficiency, into outright cell death. And this lethal competition was dependent on XRP1. They could also rescue the monosomic cells by giving them an extra copy of RPL26, proving it was linked to that specific gene dosage.
Okay, super competition, lethal competition. Any others?
Finally, they saw hints of something like compensation. In some regions, like their region 2, the monosomic cells didn't show a clear growth defect or signs of being outcompeted when next to their trisomic twins. Instead, what sometimes happened was the trisomic clones seemed to be lost from the tissue over time.
The trisomic ones got lost.
Yeah, suggesting perhaps a non-autonomous role. Maybe the trisomic cells were somehow supporting the growth of their monosomic neighbors, or perhaps triggering nearby normal cells to proliferate and fill the space, a sort of compensatory proliferation. The picture here is a bit less clear, but it suggests yet another type of interaction.
Wow. It really is like a complex cellular dance, isn't it? A constant negotiation for space and survival.
That's a great way to put it. And it shows just how many different ways that dance can play out depending on the specific genetic context and the neighbors involved. And these findings provide really critical insights into how aneuploid cells, which we know are super common in early human embryos, are normally cleared out so effectively that cleanup is vital for healthy development.
And it seems this Drosophila work offers a different angle on trisomies compared to maybe yeast or cell culture studies. What do you make of that difference?
I think it's really significant. As we discussed, unlike studies showing trisomies are often harmful, this research in a living fly tissue found large segmental trisomies didn't have a major inherent negative impact, at least on growth and survival in this time frame.
Why the difference, do you think?
Well, it raises important questions. Maybe the time frame matters. Perhaps negative effects take longer to show up than the period they observed. Or maybe those positive cell interactions in the tissue actively mask or compensate for any potential intrinsic problems the trisomic cells might have. It really underscores that we need to consider the context, the tissue environment, and cell interactions when thinking about the effects of aneuploidy. It's not just about the cell itself.
Beyond the fascinating biology, what are the broader implications? Does this tell us anything about human health or maybe point towards new therapeutic ideas?
I think it does. Firstly, it suggests the fly genome, and likely the human genome too, is probably much more densely packed with these haploinsufficient regions than we appreciated.
Regions where losing just one copy causes problems.
Exactly. Places where even a single gene, like RPL26, or maybe a small handful of genes, can significantly hurt cell growth and survival. Many human genes are predicted to be haploinsufficient, so this likely applies to us too.
And how does that connect to health?
Well, this widespread haploinsufficiency, combined with these potent cell competition mechanisms they uncovered, provides a really strong explanation for how early human embryos managed to clear out those aneuploid cells so robustly. It's a built-in quality control system.
So it helps ensure healthy development.
Yes. And potentially, it could even be a mechanism that helps counteract the accumulation of mutations in tumor suppressor genes. Many of those function in a haploinsufficient way in cancer, lose one copy, and you're partway to trouble. The study suggests that the combined hit of chromosome loss due to haploinsufficiency, plus the cell competition that gets ramped up by the presence of those complementary trisomic cells, might be really critical for getting rid of potentially cancerous aneuploid cells early on.
So let's try to summarize. What are the really big takeaways from Dr. Fusari and her colleagues' work? What's the main message we should leave with?
I think the biggest message is that this study gives us a powerful in vivo model to watch aneuploidy play out in real time in a tissue. And it fundamentally shifts our view. The removal of aneuploid cells isn't just something the cell decides on its own. It's profoundly shaped by these complex active interactions with its neighbors. Cell competition is key.
It's not just cell autonomous.
Exactly. And that has huge implications for how we think about normal embryonic development, where the system works well to clear out faulty cells, and also for diseases like cancer, where aneuploid cells somehow escape this surveillance and persist. It also tells us that our genomes are packed with these dosage-sensitive spots that are crucial for keeping cells fit and tissues healthy.
This research clearly answers some big questions, but like all good science, it must open up even more avenues, right? Where does the research go from here?
Oh, absolutely. A major challenge now is to find ways to really cleanly separate the intrinsic effects of having an extra chromosome segment, trisomy, from the effects that only happen because it's interacting with its monosomic twin.
How could they do that?
They'd need new genetic tools, methods to generate only the segmental trisomies in isolation without the monosomic counterpart. That's technically very challenging. More work is also needed to pin down the specific genes driving things like the super competition they saw. You mentioned the flower gene was in one of those regions. Understanding its role would be fascinating.
And the compensation idea?
Yes, confirming the mechanisms behind that potential compensatory proliferation is another important next step. And of course, relating this all back to humans are the pathways clearing aneuploid cells in human embryos, things like senescence or immune system involvement, similar to what's seen here or in other contexts. Lots to explore. And we should also acknowledge the limitations, right?
Of course.
As we just discussed, the current TwinSpot system doesn't let you look at trisomies completely alone. So disentangling intrinsic versus interaction effects is tough. Also, the experiments were done over about 72 hours of fly larval development. It's possible that some negative effects of trisomies might only become apparent over longer timescales, which wouldn't be seen here.
That makes sense. It's a snapshot, albeit a very detailed one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been a really insightful exploration into the, frankly, intricate world of aneuploidy and cell competition. It's quite remarkable how this delicate balance of chromosomes impacts everything, and how cells are constantly interacting, competing, cooperating to maintain that balance. It really makes you appreciate the unseen cellular drama happening inside us all the time.
It really does. And these fundamental insights from model organisms like Drosophila are just so crucial. They provide the foundation, spark new questions, and ultimately pave the way for understanding human biology and disease much better.
What stands out to you from this exploration? What new questions does it raise in your mind? Keep those thoughts coming.
This episode is based on an open access article under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License, CC BY 4.0. You'll find the DOI and a link to the license in the episode description. Our website, featuring longer episodes, is currently undergoing construction. We are diligently working on enhancing the immersive experience for our listeners, one episode at a time.